Reading old letters can almost allow you to step back in time.
Sure miss the greenness of everything in Rockford. Trees, grass, and also Ma's good meals and clean clothes all the time. Never worry, Ma, because I'm a man now and I could take care of myself. Love to all. Ralph the Private.
That's from a 1941 letter written by a Rockford soldier sent home to his family. We learn more about their story. Plus, state officials and prison advocates met last week as a part of a five-hour hearing on the Illinois justice system. We'll hear from some of the stakeholders who testified and learn more about the Illinois Youth Center in Harrisburg. But first, a law directed state officials to screen all newborns for a deadly disease 10 years ago, but testing is only now being administered. We'll find out what took so long to start saving lives. I'm Liz Westfield. That's all coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. 10 years ago, the Illinois Department of Public Health made a law requiring newborns be tested for a disease called Krabbe, a devastating neurological condition that is inherited. Kids with Krabbe normally don't make it past the age of 10 if the disease isn't caught in time. But the state didn't start testing for this disease until Monday of this week, according to the Illinois Department of Public Health. And that's after reporting in the Chicago Tribune found that public health officials were in fact failing to test babies for Krabbe. Joining me now is Patricia Calhoun, who reported on this for the Chicago Tribune, and a mother, Natasha Spencer, who is acutely aware of this issue. Her son is Keenan Spencer Witzak, a six-year-old South Shore boy whose condition would have been identified at birth had the 2007 screening law been implemented on time. Both are online on the line from Chicago. Patricia and Natasha, thanks so much for joining me on the 21st.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So, Natasha, I'd like to start with you. Where are you at the moment, and how is Keenan doing right now?
So right now we are at home. I typically will have nursing assistants during the day, but I don't on Wednesdays, so Keenan's in my care exclusively today. I just repositioned him. He's having a little bit of difficulty breathing, so I have one hand on the phone, and my other hand is on his chin supporting his jaw. He has very little muscle tone. So his jaw is lax, and because he uses his accessory muscles, meaning he lifts his shoulders to get an inhale, both those two things combined make for a very laborious way of breathing. So I'm assisting him with his breathing right now, and he's on oxygen and is getting fed through a G-tube, which is a piece of equipment that allows the milk to go directly into his stomach.
So can you share with us how you first discovered signs that he was sick? Was this immediately after his birth, or did it take some time?
It took some time. So he progressed normally. There were, you know, little bouts of fussiness here and there, but those were typical. Approaching 5 months, he was, you know, any day now he was going to sit up. Keenan has an older sister, Tamsin, who is now 9. And, of course, they tell you don't compare your two children, and she was ahead of the curve on most things, and I just thought he was struggling a little bit. And he never made, 6 months came, he never sat up. He didn't start to, obviously, if you're not going to sit up, you're not going to start to crawl. So it's just a domino effect from there. And then it got to the point where he was losing his motor skills in his hands and his fingers, and those were really the red flag indicators for me to get to the pediatrician immediately, and we went from there.
So at what point did you receive the diagnosis of Krabbe disease?
I received the diagnosis, so end of September we were admitted to Comer Children's Hospital for diagnostic testing, and then 2 weeks after that, October 11th, we received his official diagnosis.
So Patricia, bringing you in here, as I understand it, there is a routine blood test that was done on Keenan, a panel for diseases before his parents took him home from the hospital. That's pretty standard. But what happened, what was supposed to happen, and what was missing?
So when the legislature passed the law, newborn screening in Illinois, it's done on every baby before they leave the hospital. They just prick a baby's heel, take a smear of blood, put it on this special filter paper, send it to the state lab. And the state lab screens for these rare diseases that require immediate treatment to dramatically change a child's life. And Krabbe is one of those diseases. And the state legislature wanted Illinois parents like Natasha Spencer, to have a choice of treatment for a child with Krabbe so that they could intervene with a transplant of stem cells from donated umbilical cord blood. And these kinds of transplants can extend life and reduce suffering. What I found in looking at 10 years of public health records was that there were various bureaucratic delays and that testing didn't get implemented over and over again. There was one hurdle after another, and the testing that was supposed to start no later than November of 2010 didn't start until this week. And during that time, babies were born with this disease, and the challenge with Krabbe is if it's not caught in the first days of life, it's too late for a transplant. The transplant has to happen before the nerve damage from Krabbe starts.
So I'm curious, in your reporting, how much did the state budget crisis play a role in any of this?
It played some role, but not actually as much a role as you would think. Because when the law was originally passed, newborn screening in Illinois isn't funded with tax dollars as we normally think about it. It's not like there's a line item in the budget, for public health and that money goes to newborn screening. Newborn screening is actually paid for by a fee charged to hospitals for every baby born. And when this law was passed, the lawmakers behind it realized that Krabbe and the other related disorders, there were four other related disorders too that they wanted to be babies to be screened for, that cost money, right? That there was costly equipment that needed to be bought. And so they allowed public health to raise the fee charged to hospitals to collect the money they needed to buy the equipment and to do the testing. One of the earliest delays was that in Illinois, in order to raise that kind of fee, you have to go through administrative rules. So when I talk about these bureaucratic delays, we're really talking about nitty-gritty bureaucracy here. Laws passed, then you have to pass administrative rules. And it took so long to get the administrative rules through, to push through a simple $19 per baby increase in that fee, that the money didn't start pouring in to help them buy the equipment until 3 years after the law passed.
Wow. So, Natasha, I just want to clarify for our listeners today, that humming sound that we heard earlier, I believe that's Keenan's suction machine, correct?
It is. Again, he lost his ability to swallow early on, so he needs assistance with the saliva and congestion in his throat.
Okay. And I also wanted to get your reaction to Patricia's comments there about this nitty-gritty bureaucracy of it all, money at play while your son's health is deteriorating. What is your response to that?
Well, some of the process you can understand, but at the same time, we're all human beings and we all can relate to each other on that level. So, when I first was put in touch with IDPH, the Illinois Department of Public Health, I thought just knowing about Keenan would be enough motivation, and that wasn't enough motivation. So I thought, okay, well, let me tell you about his story. Let me give you some nitty-gritty details to counteract that. Surely that's going to be enough. Well, that wasn't enough. Maybe knowing the Chicago Tribune is writing an article will be enough. That wasn't enough. Maybe getting published into the paper would be enough. That's not enough. It took all the way, it took putting them in a position of not having a choice to address this issue through a legislative hearing to get them to take action. And, that's just, you're dealing with people who are intelligent and you would think compassionate on a personal level. So, my question as a mother dealing with like the emotional consequences of all this, where's that? How does that disconnect come into play? I feel so let down. I guess there's really no word to describe sort of the umbrella of all the emotional components of this.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. You try to reconcile with, I get it, there's policies, there's bureaucracies,
right.
You have to check things off a list, but I have a son who is dealing with a disease, and I want someone to take that seriously and listen to that. And we also reached out to the Illinois Department of Public Health to join us today. They declined, but they did send a statement. They acknowledged that getting testing up and running has taken longer than expected and that they've been working on it over the years. They said the biggest reason it's taken so long is because agreeing on a contract with someone who could provide the test has been extremely difficult. They cited three different attempts to agree on a contract, one with a company they said could do testing more efficiently, one with New York State, and one with the Mayo Clinic. All of these fell through. Finally, the Department of Public Health says they were able to come to an agreement with the University of Illinois Chicago. And I want to bring in Dr. Doug Carlson into this conversation. He's the chief of pediatrics at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. Dr. Carlson, welcome to the 21st and welcome to the conversation.
Well, thank you for the invitation to join you.
Oh, absolutely. So, Dr. Carlson, what's the prognosis for children diagnosed with Krabbe?
Well, the prognosis for children with Krabbe disease, which is an autosomal recessive, meaning both parents have to be carriers to transmit the disease to one of their children, is not good. The 3-year survivability is just is about 20%. Most children do pass away by the time they're 10, and there's a progressive, devastating neurological disorder.
So could you give us a sense of the difference that an immediate testing would have made for a case like Keenan's or other babies with Krabbe?
Well, the damage does occur very quickly. What can happen with the newborn screen? We test many diseases. The number of diseases we've increased that we test as a newborn have gone up from just 2 or 3 in the last 10 or 15 years to 20 or 30. There's a number of diseases like this that we test that are very rare, but there is some chance of ameliorating the path. There is no cure for Krabbe's disease, but it is true that if we recognize it, mm-hmm. and we provide a stem cell transplant, that there have been reports of a few children that have had near normal survivability, and most children have increased survivability, but still with most with significant neurological problems, although certainly not to the extent they would have untreated with a stem cell transplant. The difficulty is stem cell transplants are still fraught with their own issues, and it's a balancing of that. But I certainly have, you know, for the families that are suffering from this with any chance of improvement, certainly have much sympathy for that as a potential change in the prognosis.
Sure. And so could you give us a sense, outside of the stem cell transplant, are there any other treatment options, or is that the single one?
That is the only treatment option. It is a loss of an enzyme, which leads to fat buildup, which causes nerve deficiencies. There are no medications, no way to change that other than with a stem cell transplant.
So, Natasha, obviously for your son, the diagnosis came relatively late. Is this treatment, this stem cell transplant, not an option for you anymore that Dr. Carlson is talking about? What are your options at this point?
So yes, that is correct. Once we had a diagnosis, Keenan's nerve damage was too far progressed to go through the transplant process. So now it's we just do everything we can to keep him as comfortable as possible, mm-hmm. and to keep him as engaged through his 5 senses. So, you know, he no longer can swallow, but he still can taste. So I make sure I give him tastes of ice cream or, you know, his favorite right now is Dr. Pepper, so I just okay. I put a little, you know, dip a Q-tip in that and put it in his mouth. So he still has as much of a human, like a typical human experience as possible. And really, it's quality of care. You know, Keenan is a very, very strong little boy. He was given 1 to 2 years to live, and he's 6 now. And so when I look at him and I look at to see how strong he is, I know that his quality of life could be vastly improved had he gone through the stem cell process, and all the things that needed to go well for him would have gone well for him. He would be in a much better place, and able to engage with the world at a higher level than he is now.
So, Patricia, back to you. There are other babies, I assume, born in Illinois with Krabbe since the law was enacted, but maybe not fully put into practice since it was passed in 2006. Do you know or have any sense of what their stories are?
Yeah. So I found, well, first of all, I should tell you that, you know, there's no official list of babies born in the state with Krabbe. So
okay.
It was just sort of reporting, trying to find, you know, who else was born in this time frame. And I found five children who were born after the law was passed. Three of them have died. Keenan is among those still surviving with Krabbe. And then there's another little girl, Lana Shelton, who lives in North Riverside, which is a suburb of Chicago. But a little girl born earlier this year, Hayden Ponce, she passed away. Logan Nichols, born in Chicago in 2015, he died earlier this year. And Dylan Maubach from Washington, Illinois, outside of Peoria. He was born in 2011, and he died in 2014. So, it's really sad.
Absolutely. And Natasha, before we let you go, you mentioned earlier that Keenan has, I believe you said, an older sister.
Yes.
This has to be incredibly hard on each member of your family for a variety of reasons, but how has she dealt with all of this?
You know, she was 2.5 when he was diagnosed. So she, you know, she is, this is all she's known. And we've let her ask questions, and we've been as honest as we can, and we think we're doing a good job, but you never know how children internalize and how they process information. And just as an example, we took the kids to see Santa Claus in a public setting, and, you know, Santa told her to take care of her brother. And, you know, that's a very innocent thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And this Santa isn't probably educated on special needs kids. And, you know, that could have gone in one ear and out the other, or it could have made her feel exceptionally responsible because
right.
Santa's telling her. So you just don't know what's going to stick and what's not going to stick. But we have an open conversation with her. She's able to say anything to us about this, express any of her emotions, whether it's anger, frustration, sadness,
yeah,
at the drop of a hat. And if I feel it's important to address bring something up with her myself, if I'm noticing something in her behavior, I will talk to her about that.
Well, Patricia, Natasha, Dr. Carlson, I just want to thank you so much for joining me on the 21st today.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. More than 100 people gathered last week as a part of a House Appropriations Public Safety Committee hearing over concerns about violence in the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice and throughout the prison system. The hearing was nearly 5 hours long. One of the facilities highlighted is one in southern Illinois that critics say has become a pipeline to prison. The facility in question is the Illinois Youth Center in Harrisburg. And since 2016, its guards and employees have pursued more criminal charges for youth on staff assaults than all the other state juvenile correction facilities combined. Ann Irving, director of the public policy for Ask Me Council 31, will join the program in just a few minutes. We'll also hear from Jenny Volen-Katz, the executive director of the John Howard Association, an independent prison watchdog group. But first, to tell us more about the hearing and the Illinois Youth Center, we're joined by ProPublica reporter Dua Eldeeb. She's on the line from Chicago. So welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So, do I want to start with this recent news? Representative Kelly Cassidy, a Chicago Democrat, was one who originally called for last week's hearing, if I'm correct. And why is that?
Yeah, so she called for it. She said she really wanted to have everyone in the room, everyone who's been involved, to talk about safety at the state's youth and adult prisons. She wanted them. She said they've been talking past each other for a long time, so let's get everyone in a room and talk about exactly what's happening. And so there they discussed what's happening in Harrisburg, and it was the state's independent juvenile ombudsman who was particularly concerned about what's happening in Harrisburg. And, you know, as the ombudsman, she gets calls from these youths and in some cases is able to review video of the incidents And so she called it a, quote, pipeline to prison, and she said it's undermining the department's efforts at reform and their mission to rehabilitate youth and increase public safety.
So can you give us a better sense of actually what's happening at that center and what you've discovered in your reporting so far?
Sure. So since 2016, employees there brought more than 40 criminal cases against youth at Harrisburg. So in the past, these incidents for youth on staff assault typically would have been handled internally. So if a youth, you know, hit a guard or inadvertently elbowed a guard, then they might have lost privileges or spent time in solitary or even had their juvenile sentence extended. Criminal charges are very rare. But that's what's happening in Harrisburg. And not only are we seeing this large number of criminal charges, but in nearly half of those cases, the youth had turned adult while in custody, had turned 18 while they were in custody, so they were charged as adults. And just to give you a sense of what we're talking about, you know, some of the assaults included, you know, spitting on or pushing guards, and then the other assaults included punching a guard. And some of the department records that I looked at refer to some of the incidents as minor.
So when we're talking about inmates being sentenced, you're talking 6, sometimes 8 years for things like hitting a guard, like you're talking about.
Yeah, so in some cases, right, shoving a guard, punching a guard, or even spitting at a guard. And so about a dozen young men from IYC Harrisburg, you know, face adult prison sentences. And so far, the ones who have been convicted have received anywhere from 3 to 8 years, meaning once they're out, they'll be convicted felons.
So before we get to a particular case, I want to ask you about, is the Harrisburg Center unique in this sense throughout the state, or are there others like it?
So what we found is pretty much across the board, assaults were on the rise. But what made Harrisburg unique was the number of criminal charges that the employees were seeking. And state officials have said that this is all kind of at odds with their mission to make the system more rehabilitative. So when you have a youth who's in, you know, the juvenile justice system, they don't want to see that youth then going directly to adult prison. But the guards I spoke to said that they were tired of going to work every day and getting beat up, cussed out, spit on, and they said the department wasn't responding to their complaints, and they felt like, you know, they no longer had the tools they needed to do their jobs effectively, so they felt like they had no other choice but to file these criminal charges.
So I was hoping you could tell us about Jalen Banks, who was an inmate there, and what exactly happened to him. What was his story?
Sure. So he was 17 when he punched a guard. They were having a struggle over a bottle of body wash. Jalen grew up in institutions from residential centers to psychiatric hospitals to group homes. He's kind of bounced around his whole life. You know, he's been involved with Department of Children and Family Services since he was 8, and he entered the juvenile justice system at 14. He's been in trouble a lot since he's been in the system, and but you know, when this staff assault charge came up, he had a couple other ones. Those were dropped. And in the end, he was sentenced to 8 years for this staff assault. And I think it's important maybe here to talk a little bit about the background, kind of what DJJ is going through. So the department itself, is as a standalone agency, is relatively young, right? It's only, you know, it was only created in 2006. And, you know, before that, juveniles were part of the adult correctional system. But when the department was created, it was out of this growing awareness that youth were different than adults and they should be treated differently in our criminal justice system.
Right. They may not understand that their actions might have these lifelong consequences, or their maturity level is not to the level of that understanding. We're talking to ProPublica reporter Dua El-Deeb, the state juvenile justice system, and in particular about her story about the Illinois Youth Center in Harrisburg. I want to bring Ann Irving into the conversation. Ann is the director of public policy for Ask Me Council 31, the union group that represents correctional officers at the juvenile facilities in Harrisburg and across the state. She joined us now also on the line from Chicago. So, Ann, welcome to the 21st and the conversation.
Thank you.
So, Ann, you were among some of the officials and advocates who were testifying during last week's hearing on the Illinois juvenile justice system. Can you quickly recap what you talked about during your testimony?
Yeah, it boils down to concern about the increasing assaults on staff, not just security staff, but also educators, counselors, mental health and medical staff, and a sense that the administration hasn't stepped up to respond to create a safer work environment and a safer environment for youth.
So when we're talking about violence against prison guards and workers at these juvenile detention centers, can you give us a sense of what the data shows?
So the increase in assaults compared to 2015 are very dramatic, and it's system-wide. The data indicates, and this is the department's own data that they share with us on a monthly basis, indicates an increase in overall assaults on staff of 64% since 2015, and that is that includes a projection for the current year, 2017, based on 9 months of data. But looked at another way, if you just look at the assault data that we have through August, which is the most recent month we have for DJJ, the assaults on staff through the month of August were already equal to the assault suffered in 2015, so with 4 months left to go in the year. So it just gives you a sense of how dramatic that increase has been. And we're talking here about anything from, as Dua mentioned, spitting or throwing urine and feces to we have members who were punched in the head, a couple of members at IYC St. Charles punched in the head so hard, beaten to the point that they have concussions and lasting medical problems resulting from them. And in the case of IYC Harrisburg, an attempted rape. So these are serious assaults as well as chronic, everyday showing up to work and knowing that you may well be asked to change your clothes and get back to work after somebody has thrown urine and feces in your face.
So when we're talking about these prison incidents, in the years past, if I'm understanding correctly, they may have resulted in loss of privileges or time in solitary confinement. When did the switch become to actually convicting them of many years in prison?
Well, there hasn't been a switch to convicting them of many years in prison. The idea here is that what we're talking about is the Department of Juvenile Justice operates IYCs with the intent of rehabilitating youth and preparing them to go back to their communities. And the concern is that both as a result of consent decrees that the department has agreed to in terms of issues like confinement, reducing the amount of confinement, but also because on their own, the Department of Juvenile Justice has curtailed some of the normal consequences for youth when they act out in a way that's dangerous. We have this spiraling situation where there isn't a consequence. And the way our members talk about it is, youth need structure, and they need rewards when they act well, and they need consequences when they don't. And the problem is that the current mechanism for dealing with youth who are acting out, this is coming from the administration, is often negotiating with them. So, you know, if I decide I'm not going to go to my room and I'm going to sit it out and not do as I'm asked, what we have is administration coming in and saying, well, tell you what, if you comply, you're going to get a pizza party. Instead of saying you're going to get a negative consequence. And now the youth who did do what they were told are sitting in their rooms and waiting for something to happen to the youth who didn't do what they were told and who's getting the reward. And that's what's setting up, we believe, this very dramatic increase in assaults.
That's Ask Me, Council 31 Director of Public Policy, Ann Irving. Ann, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're continuing this conversation about state juvenile justice system and, in particular, Illinois Youth Center that's down in Harrisburg. I'd like to introduce Jenny Volen-Katz, Executive Director of the John Howard Association and Independent Prison Watchdog Group. Jenny, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much.
So, Jenny, you also testified last week at the House Appropriations hearing. What were your thoughts on the dialogue there? Were you satisfied with what you heard and what happened?
Well, I think it's progress that Representative Cassidy called for this hearing, just to get the conversation started. And I was heartened to hear that she, along with other committee members, viewed this as a beginning of a conversation, not a full conversation. Even though it took close to 4.5 hours, you know, I do think we were only beginning to scratch the surface. A couple of things I'd like to point out, having heard both Ann Irving and Dua speak a bit about the situation mm-hmm. in Harrisburg, there's a couple of things I'd like to add about the situation.
Okay.
First of all, I want to point out that assault is defined very broadly inside both the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice and the Illinois Department of Corrections. I also want people to understand that when you take that broad definition of assault and then you apply it to a correctional officer, the game sort of changes. So it becomes a felony. And so it's a different kind of offense. And in that very broad definition of assault, it includes things like if a youth were to fly a paper airplane and it were to touch a staff member, that would be considered an assault. So that doesn't mean that some of them haven't been serious, but many of them have not been. And I think understanding how broad the definition is important to the conversation. The okay. other thing I'd want to point out is the first youth who really came onto everybody's radar, who was prosecuted in the way we're talking about, which is a staff person from IYC Harrisburg leaving work and what we call walking in the charges, which means going in as a private citizen, mm-hmm. not utilizing the disciplinary process set up by the Department of Juvenile Justice, but going as a private citizen, which, of course, they have every right to do, and becoming a complaining witness, in essence. And the first case that came onto everybody's radar that really started this conversation was a young man who got 6 years in adult prison for spitting. So the underlying behavior in that assault was spitting, and that led to 6 years. And he's currently, incarcerated right now in an adult facility.
Was that Jalen Banks that we were talking about earlier?
No.
No, that was a different individual.
That was a different pro, okay. Yes. And I think he was sentenced as an adult, so I could probably use his name, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
That doesn't seem like a fair thing to do without permission.
Absolutely. So I wanted to get your opinion broadly. If you believe these larger juvenile detention centers are serving their purpose, which is rehabilitating troubled youth and reinstating them back into society.
Yeah, no, that's an easy one to answer. No, they're not. They're trying. A lot of what's happened stems from the consent decree in the litigation, R.J. v. Miller. It was filed by the ACLU in 2012. And in many ways, it's taken our system really far. And there are some people who would say it's taken us almost as far as we can go. And I think that what we're starting to see is sort of where the rubber meets the road. You know, the reality with these assaults is, while assaults may be up, and all the numbers I've seen indicate that they are up in the juvenile system, staff self-reported work-related injuries are down, and that number is down by over 20%. So I think we also have to talk about perception. So mm-hmm. on the one hand, we have programming and increased mental health staffing and things that the consent decree demands that the department come into compliance on. On the other hand, we have a huge piece of this that requires a different way of thinking, and the buy-in has to be system-wide, not just at the top. And I think that is a struggle for any system. I think it's particularly difficult in a system that was based on large youth prisons that were not originally designed to be rehabilitative.
Mm-hmm.
I think for staff, having had certain consequences available to mete out for youth behavior,
right.
such as use of confinement punitively,
mm-hmm.
I think having that taken away and perhaps not feeling like there were enough options for replacement to manage behavior has been a problem. But I think it's frankly always going to be a problem in a large institution. Yeah. I mean, one of the things we're seeing is that kids in the system now, we have done what we set out to do, which is to keep the low-level offenders out of state custody. And so
yeah.
as we pare down the population, the kids that were left in custody are really our high-risk, high-needs kids. So
Yeah.
You know, I think Ann Irving's right. These are difficult kids.
Absolutely.
And I don't think anybody's saying, you know, yeah, that they're not. So the question is, when that's your population, you know, how do you rehabilitate them? And I think all the research and all of the success that's happened in other states is indicative of the fact that what we need to do is move to a model of small, regional, close-to-home facilities where kids
all right.
really get the help they need.
Absolutely, Jenny. I apologize. We are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us on the 21st. This is the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Lots of us have boxes and bins in our basements, attics, and garages. Maybe some of them off-site in storage lockers, and they probably need a good cleaning out. Imagine if you opened up one of those boxes, though, only to discover a key to the past. That's what happened to one Arizona man, Joe Alosi, who frequently bids on storage units sight unseen. In one of them, he found plastic bins filled with hundreds of handwritten letters dated back to World War II for members of one Rockford family, the Ides. Frank, a Marine, Ralph, a member of the Army, John, a member of the Air Force, and Stanford received a deferment. The letters relay the family's fears during the war, along with their memories of growing up in Rockford. Alosi, a veteran himself, recognized this as a treasure trove, and he contacted Washington Post reporter Dan Lamoth. Dan is with us right now on the line from his home in Washington, D.C., and we're also joined by librarian Jean Lithgow of the Rockford Public Library, who's an expert on local history and genealogy, as well as Scott Ludanowski, the director of the Veterans Memorial Hall in Rockford. I want to thank you all for joining me on the 21st.
Thank you.
So, Dan, Joe Alosi in Arizona reached out to you after discovering these letters. Do you know why he came to you, and what did you immediately, or how did you immediately know they were special?
When he first came to us, I think he was in part trying to put this sort of mystery together himself. You know, he had something to the effect of 700 or 800 letters.
Wow.
He had read through them at great length, but there was no logical existing family member that he could find. None of these brothers had children. Them being in Illinois, he was in Arizona. It didn't make sense why the letters were out there. So he was really, I think, in part looking for help to see if there was a story here and trying to see if he could put this all together himself. He was just fascinated.
Well, and Gene, I imagine the sheer scope of this collection is fairly rare, would you say?
I would say it's very rare, yes.
So, and these letters are mostly handwritten by members of one family, the Ides family, who lived in Rockford before and during World War II. So could you give us a little bit more information about them, perhaps starting with the parents? When did they first settle in Rockford? What was their situation through their time there?
Well, it turns out that both of their parents came from Bergen, Norway, although they were married here in Rockford about 1908, so they came earlier than that. I don't know if they knew each other beforehand or not. But Lawrence, or Lorenz, as he is listed both ways in the news bank, was a cabinet maker for one of the Rockford furniture companies, because that was a good industry to be in at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There are other references throughout the earlier newspapers to activities, you know, church activities, social activities.
And so talking about Frank, their oldest son, he graduated from Rockford Central High School in 1933. And in October of 1939, at the age of 26, he enlisted as a Marine shortly after Germany invaded Poland. And 2 years later, Frank's younger brother, Ralph, quit his factory job to enlist as an Army infantryman. And then they were both stationed in California. And initially, Frank was optimistic. In fact, he wrote, quote, "All this falseness of war, it's hooey." But then we have December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor, and their tone really changes. Here's a bit of audio from the podcast that the Washington Post released. Dan, you're familiar with this. You had actors reading voices of the letters. This is Ralph the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And listeners, I want you to be advised this does contain some offensive language.
Monday, December 8th, 1941. Dear John,
Yep, it's me again. Those damn Japs gummed up my furlough. Can't leave camp till further orders. No telling when I'll get home now. Won't even get Christmas off. Stood 5.5 hours of straight guard last night. Shoot anyone suspicious lurking around in the wee hours of the morning. Ord is one big guard. No more visitors.
So, Gene, I want to talk a little bit about that language. Of course, that contains racist language, as we just heard, towards the Japanese forces. And I assume that was common at the time. But what is that like to experience that, read that, and hear that today?
Well, for me, because I've been aware of it for a long time, I say that's the way it was. That was the way it was done then. I will comment, a few months ago, A younger woman came in, and we were looking up some World War II research, and there was a headline using the word Japs, excuse me, because that's the word that was in the paper. Mm-hmm. And she kind of gasped in horror, and I had to tell her, that's the way it was then.
Dan, the youngest brother, John, then joins up. So though Ralph has warned him to avoid combat, he signs up anyway. So what happens next, and do they all experience combat?
So John is the youngest brother of four. He initially was sort of trying to feel out where he fit in. There's talk in the letters of him joining the Navy, of joining the Army Air Forces, and really just trying to sort it out. He apparently was somewhat mechanically inclined, and his brothers wanted him to stay out of combat. So he ultimately enlists on his own in the Army Air Forces and tries to find his way to a unit in California. He ultimately does. He doesn't see actual combat, but he isn't part of the combat missions. He was working off the Pacific island of Tinian, which is where a lot of bombing missions in Japan were flown from.
And speaking of Frank, as you mentioned him there, let's get another sense of the letters that have been found. Here's one that focuses on combat, since we're talking about that. And again, this is a clip of the actors reading the letters from the Washington Post.
Dear Mother, after the battle is over and all is well, we are on our way again. And what I saw, I will never forget. I was on a gun crew that shot down a Jap bomber coming right at us, about 20 feet off the water and 25 feet from our boat. In all, our ship shot down 5 bombers coming right close to the ship, trying to crash into it. High bombers overhead dropping eggs all around us. At night, a real battle was on. We can't talk about the losses of war, so I guess all I'll say is we won the battle. It was sure a 4th of July, and it happened 8 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor. This being my birthday, I'm enjoying it as much as possible. The Red Cross has been giving us books, sewing kits, sweaters, socks, and many other things of value. It looks as if we might have some rest for a while anyway. I'm feeling fine as usual, and know you and the boys are all behind us in this cause to win. I'll write soon, and keep smiling. Love, Frank.
So that's a letter written by Frank Ides. We just heard a voice actor read Frank's words. Those were wrote to his mother during World War II. That's from a podcast released by the Washington Post, and we have reporter Dan Lamoff here. Dan, Frank's homecoming was in 1943, but as I'm to understand, it was not easy. Can you describe what he went through to come home?
Yes, Frank's homecoming was actually interrupted. He was initially sent home from the Pacific with malaria. He healed up on the way. He made a recovery. But on his way to take a 30-day vacation or leave from his unit in California, he sort of froze up on the famous Navy pier in Chicago on his way back to Rockford. And authorities at the time found him. They thought he was paranoid. They put him in a military hospital north of the city. And really, over the next 30 years, you see letters both written by Frank and involving Frank, where he struggles on and off. He's in and out of hospitals. He's arrested. He's got a drinking problem and really struggles with just how to cope with what he's seen and done.
Mm-hmm. You've been hearing Dan describe that experience of trying to come home from World War II. Scott Lindowski, I'd like to bring you in to the conversation. You're the director of the Veterans Memorial Hall in Rockford. And what was the experience, or could you say or speak to whether or not this experience of coming home from World War II was common at the time?
Sure. I believe that it was probably more common than sort of relayed by the veterans, especially World War II veterans. They weren't very open about their experiences during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them did have what we now call PTSD. Sometimes it was called shell shock, battle fatigue, and those sorts of things. So I think it was more common than what was reported by the veterans.
So you worked to preserve the stories of the veterans in Winnebago County. What did you read in the letters as far as something that people could really relate to? Were there exceptional stories that you found, too?
Yeah, there were some exceptional stories, but just the fact that the stories are there and they exist. I know the Library of Congress has been doing their Veterans History Project, trying to capture these stories. Because again, the World War II veterans really, you know, kept quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I know family members who have watched their loved ones give their history project interviews, and they'll say, "We never knew that.
Right?
We just
yeah.
never knew that that happened."
Well, speaking of the families, I do want to talk about the other side of this, the families at home waiting for their loved ones, waiting for a letter from their loved ones. So, Jean, what can you tell us about what life was like in the Rockford area during this time?
Well, we had a couple things. Camp Grant was located just south of Rockford, where the current Chicago-Rockford International Airport is. And one of the things that the ministers or the priests would say during the church services on Sunday, we have some people here from Camp Grant. Won't you take them home for dinner, for Sunday dinner?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people did that. But yes, people were waiting for their letters, and there were, of course, certain shortages because materials had to be deployed for the troops instead, and of course, you know, limited rubber, et cetera.
So, Scott, the Veterans Memorial Hall is a living memorial in Rockford to the veterans from all U.S. wars. So where do you see these letters fitting in as memorial artifacts and historical pieces into your mission and your organization?
Well, the letters are a great connection to the past and the actual feeling of those veterans. You really can't get that unless you can interact with them,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, have this sort of connection. We create displays where we focus on individual veterans, and when we have a personal artifact like that, we will put them out, you know, we'll transcribe them. People can read them. They can really get a sense of what they were going through at that time.
Oh, I think the letters are really great for that, that idea of, you know, we know the history behind the war, but what's the human impact and what were people thinking and feeling, especially in the context of a place here in Illinois. So, Dan, what's going to happen to these letters now that they've come to light?
There's a couple things left going here. One is the podcast you mentioned that will be rolling out with a new episode each Wednesday into January. As far as the letters themselves, that's Mr. Alozzi, Joe Alozzi's call. He's still the owner of these letters. We found what appears to be the closest surviving family member.
Okay.
She is interested to see them, but also very much sees them as Joe's letters. She's just very happy that when he found these in the storage unit some years ago, he kept them and invested in trying to figure this out rather than just throwing them away.
You don't really know what he plans to do with the letters, but they are his. He's not going to be giving them to the family, or she would rather him have them.
They're sorting it out. She hoped to see them someday go to a museum.
Okay.
But their short-term history is kind of up in the air. He's fielding a variety of requests. I've had a number of people come to me trying to have me forward requests, variety of museums all over the country. So, I mean, there's certainly interest.
So, Dan, before we go, I'm to understand that you did a little digging into your own past after reporting on this story. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
I did. And I think a lot like, you know, many, many others that are my age and, you know, their 30s and, you know, they had grandparents that served. And you know, there are a lot of stories that get shared, partly because the veterans back then didn't want to, and partly just the years that have gone by. So much like I did with the Ide family, I put in requests for my own family's history. And, you know, I came back and it was partly a fact-finding exercise and partly I was really invested in it and learned that my great uncle was a demolition specialist who served in the Battle of the Bulge and spent a lot of time in France during World War II.
I think we all might be a little bit more inspired to take a deeper dive into our family tree and our histories. I want to thank Dan Lamoth, Gene Lithgow, also Scott Ludanowski for joining us on the 21st today for this conversation about World War II letters. You can find links to more info on those letters on our website and on Twitter at 21STShow. But that is all the time we have for today. We are produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecilio and Bob Holly. Libby Foster is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive director. Special thanks to Public Access for our theme music. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. This is the 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.